Hello. This is the Winchester and District Talking newspaper for the week ending Friday, the 3rd of August, 2018. The extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle this week have been edited by Angela Ling, Carol Fraser and Jane Thomas. Your readers today are Maria Head.
Hello.
John Regan.
Hi there.
And Frieda Bates.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Tom Williams. The main headlines this week are GP's move to new surgery in doubt, top sports agency Slate's centre plans, and new role for antiques market. So may we have the story behind the first headline, please, Maria?
Yes. GP's move to new surgery in doubt. The move of the Winchester GP surgery to a proposed state-of-the-art building is in doubt, according to civic chiefs. St Clement's Surgery, currently in Tanner Street, has been negotiating with the City Council to relocate to the corner of Upper Brook Street and Friars Gate by May 2019. But council documents concerning a planning application for the current building has revealed a rift between the two parties. In a report to the Planning Committee, the council's head of estates, Kevin Warren, said, "Despite discussions between the council and the doctors over a number of years, it is now looking unlikely that an agreement will be reached. The GP practice has around 16,000 patients. The rift comes as the planning committee refused to allow office use at the Tanner Street practice. The decision has been branded as misguided by City Councillor Kim Gottlieb, who owns the building and plans to appeal the decision. As previously reported, a bid had been launched to see the building in Tanner Street change to business uses that covers offices, research and development or light industrial. The planning committee last week heard fears from planning officers who recommended the bid be refused, that if the go-ahead was given, it would result in the loss of a local facility. However, Councillor Gottlieb, who is director of applicant firm Lockstill Limited, told the Chronicle before the meeting, "The purpose of the application is simply so that the building can be put to good use if the practice ever decides to leave. Our commitment not to implement an approval until the practice has made that decision and moved is enshrined in a legal agreement we have offered, but the planners have rejected. As things stand, there is no proposal to develop the broader site, and unlike the council, I can't afford for the building to sit vacant for years doing nothing. I am not party to the discussions between the practice and the council, but I understand that the terms offered on the proposed new surgery on the Upper Brook Street car park are still not sufficiently attractive to persuade the practice to relocate. I have offered them a new long lease should they decide to stay put. I'm sure you will also recall Councillor Stephen Godfrey's assurance given in November 2015 that the new surgery would be completed in August 2017. Councillor Brian Lumming, who voted in favour of the change, questioned the officer's recommendation for refusal. He said, "The landlord, Councillor Gottlieb, has said he is quite happy for the doctors to stay put until the new surgery is built. I can't see the problem." Following the decision to reject the proposal by 4-2, Councillor Gottlieb said, "The council's reason for refusal that the proposal would result in the loss of a local facility is misguided and will be challenged at appeal." Councillor Gottlieb added, we offered to enter into a legal agreement whereby the consent would only be implemented if the practice chose to relocate. If they do relocate, the building needs to be put to good use while the plans for the larger development come forward. The practice's requirements are paramount in my thinking and have been all along, whilst campaigning to ensure that it wasn't prematurely evicted by Henderson as a result of the council's failure to deliver the new surgery as promised. However, councillor leader Caroline Horrell hit back saying, "The council's long-standing ambition for a replacement surgery in the heart of the city remains the same. Currently, the council is awaiting a decision by the doctors in St Clement's practice. The outcome of this will determine further work on plans for any new surgery development on Upper Brook Street. Any implication that the council's terms and conditions of a proposed surgery are the reason for any delay is misleading. St Clement's was asked to comment but had not responded at the time of going to press."
Top sports agency slates centre plans. A national agency has heavily criticised plans for Winchester's new sports centre, despite the City Council saying it has worked with them throughout the process. Sport England, the SE, has published its comments on the designs, which are currently in the process of seeking planning permission, and has issued a holding objection. The 9-page critique includes feedback from several other sporting bodies and concerns a range of issues, ranging from a lack of detail over mitigation measures for the loss of a sports pitch to the size of the hall and its glazing. However, the document does include some good news for the council, with support from England Squash and Swim England. The main concern of Sport England appears to be over the loss of a football pitch. Owen Neal, SE's planning manager, told City Council planners, "The Football Foundation and Hants County FA comment that they object to the proposal on the basis of the lack of detail about the required mitigation package to compensate for the loss of pitch provision." Although a letter of comfort has been provided to the league by the council, this is not considered sufficiently robust. Sport England would have expected more detail at this stage. Another significant issue with Sport England was the 8-court sports hall, which has proved to be contentious since the decision to reject a 12-court hall last year. Mr. Neal said, "Our initial suggestion was for a 12-court hall to allow for future growth across all sports. Currently, the proposed design is 2 metres short to accommodate hockey." He added that Winchester Hockey Club is a growing and aspirational club, which has seen a 34% growth in membership over the past 2 seasons. Meanwhile, Badminton England also objected, saying that the proposals do not provide a functional design that will facilitate the growing local demand. Other concerns related to the lack of spectator viewing capacity, a level of changing facilities that would seem to be below what is needed, and the lack of group changing rooms that would be needed on child protection grounds for schools and other parties of young people. This is a major concern, he says. Despite the holding objection, Sport England did concede an improvement on the current River Park Leisure Centre. Mr. Neal said, "Overall, we consider the proposal represents an improvement on the existing provision." In response, Councillor Lisa Griffiths, portfolio holder for Health and Wellbeing, said, "Detailed discussions have been held with Sport England and national governing bodies over the last 2 years. A detailed technical submission was received on July the 25th, and Sport England was asked for further information regarding sports pitches and clarification of some design elements. This feedback comes after the Council Leisure Centre Committee last week agreed not to make any changes to the current planning application, which is due to go before a planning committee in September.
New arts role for antique market. Civic chiefs have confirmed Winchester's historic antique market will now become a hub for theatre, music and the arts in the first redevelopment under the Silver Hill 2 scheme. Officially known as the Central Winchester Regeneration Project, CWR, the scheme aims to revamp the area surrounding the building, with the improvement of the antique market being one of Winchester City Council's short-term goals. The newly formed Nutshell Arts Community Interest Company plans to rebrand the venue as The Nutshell and offer it as an accessible place for creatives to use for rehearsals, workshops, exhibitions and small-scale productions. Alongside resident companies, the Discarded Nut Theatre Company and Encore Youth Theatre. It comes after the council approved spending £25,000 to bring the vacant building, dating from the 1890s, back to life, with The Nutshell aiming to fundraise £35,000 for essential building works and set-up costs. Council leader Caroline Horrell said, "We are thrilled to have such a vibrant and exciting company take up residence in the antique market. We're committed to developing our existing buildings and refurbishing them to provide businesses with the space they need, while the redevelopment proposals for the wider Winchester Central area are developed. This company has a great community offering and has worked hard to develop their ideas of how they would use this space. I'm looking forward to seeing the resident companies and other artists creating some inspiring theatre and music and to benefit from using the space for their projects and rehearsals." The Nutshell is set to be run by Winchester-based Noel Jones and Harriet Morris, who currently run the Discarded Nut Theatre Company and Encore Youth Theatre, alongside Anna Harding, the Winchester Jazz Festival director and a member of the Spitfire Sisters. They have worked with Richard Harrison of Snug Architects to ensure the space within the venue can be fully accessible. Ms. Jones said, "Since we set up the Discarded Nut Theatre Company 8 years ago, we recognised how difficult it can be to find appropriate performance and creative space. We plan to open for public hire from October, but we'll be launching the opening of the venue in September."
That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the obituary notices. The following deaths have been announced. Boer, Douglas Boer, peacefully aged 94. Chapman, Sheila Chapman at Winchester Hospital, aged 86. Dixon, Peter Morley Dixon at home, aged 81. Hall, Warner Hall, peacefully at home, aged 79. Harrison, David Rodney Harrison, suddenly and peacefully at Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 82. Kitcher, Hans Werner Kitcher, at home, aged 74. Rayner, Stephen Rayner, aged 53. Silke, Natalie Silke, peacefully, aged 92. Thurley, Anne Christian Thurley, aged 65 after a short illness. And Wilcock, Leslie Edward Raymond Wilcock, peacefully, aged 92. Christian comment this week is read by Maria. Thank you, Maria.
And Christian comment is written by Rosemary A. Baker this week and very topically headed, "A Transfiguration into a Love Island." The final of Love Island was on ITV on Monday night, or so I am informed. I knew nothing about it at all until I heard my nephew speak at his wedding reception, making several references to it. Looking around as everyone roared with laughter, I realised that I was a member of a very small minority who was similarly ignorant and hadn't a clue what he was talking about. Although a reality television programme about sex and love might not usually be considered suitable material for family viewing, the received wisdom is that not only has it been immensely successful in terms of the viewing numbers, but it has succeeded in bringing families together. Parents and teenagers to watch together, something quite rare these days. This morning, I caught the end of an interview with Paddy Ashdown on Radio 4. He spoke of an occasion when, looking across Salisbury Plain, he realised that he no longer recognised this country as the one he thought he knew. Instead of a tolerant, caring nation that accepted people of all colours, creeds and backgrounds, we had become a land of hatred and non-acceptance. He was very sad as he reflected on how this could have happened and whether there was anything that could be done to change this. This Sunday, the Christian Church celebrates the Feast of the Transfiguration. The story is told in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke. The Gospels relate that one day Jesus took three disciples up a mountain where they witnessed his transfiguration into divine form. His face shone like the sun, his garments became brilliantly white, and a voice from heaven proclaimed that this was the Son of God. Transfiguration was first used in English as the name of this biblical event, and the Feast of the Transfiguration remains the name of a holy day. So the word has always kept a somewhat religious and almost always positive tone. A face may be transfigured by joy, and an ugly duckling may be slowly transfigured into a radiant beauty. And as Harry Potter fans know, transfiguration is a subject long taught at the Hogwarts School by Minerva McGonagall. So transfiguration means changed in a very special way. The overall message of the Gospels, and indeed the Christian faith itself, is that we can all be transfigured or changed by the love of God shown to us in Jesus. It would be good to think this country could be a love island, but perhaps a different form of love, not the sexual type, but the sort of brotherly love where we care for each other and the strangers we meet in our lives.
Moving on to letters to the editor, the first letter is read by John. Thank you, John.
Yes, and this letter is headed White Elephants, and it comes from Jock MacDonald. Sir, in your final July edition, three articles, plus your editorial, highlight problems facing Winchester. Problems that are a microcosm of those facing the whole country. On the one hand, we have the magnificent efforts of the university in making sure that its new building on Romsey Road is impressive, not just for its facilities, but also for facing the future. It includes, quotes, a combined heat and power plant, heat recovery systems, solar photovoltaic panels, rainwater harvesting, a green roof, etc., etc. Just compare this to the lack of such features in the proposed sports centre at Bar End. Councillor Griffiths criticises WINAC for not raising these issues at an advisory stage. However that might be, we now have less than 32 years when the climate change crunch will come to get this sort of detail right. As for the traffic arrangements on Barton Farm, are Winchester's MP and council leaders really capable of thinking that far ahead? It seems to have escaped them that, by keeping the main roads as it is, it will still mean a huge pile-up at the crossroads below the train station. Bar a radical solution, the traffic will still try to escape into Hairstock and Full Flood. Part of the radical solution is to put the traffic through Barton Farm so that, one, drivers will be encouraged to use the specially designated park and ride, and two, that residents of Barton Farm going into the city centre will use buses passing nearby or their bicycles along the old Andover Road. These measures will be much more appropriate for crunch time in 2050. The government has been criticised for not tackling the carbon emissions generated by traffic. But now that plastic in the oceans and fires burning across the Northern Hemisphere have made climate change and human pollution obvious to all, politicians have a chance to rethink their priorities. Winnack is right to criticise the, quote, serious inadequacies within the transport assessment for the sports centre. I sympathise with your editorial that urges immediate decisions, but we don't want a centre that becomes a dangerous white elephant. And Jock MacDonald lives in Stockbridge Road, Full Flood, Winchester.
This letter from Simon Lever of Juniper Close Badger Farm is headed Sports Centre Plans Positive Benefit. Sir, the proposed sports and leisure centre at Bar End will be of positive benefit, providing facilities for the health, fitness and well-being of the community. To put the kibosh on the proposals, as in Chronicle Leader comment July the 26th, would be a crying shame. Nobody would benefit, and the growing population would lose out on such an amazing facility. The fact that building and operating such a sports and leisure centre is feasible should be celebrated. Because of the delays, the estimated costs have obviously risen. That is a fact of life, when projects are needlessly delayed. However, the consultation process has been observed, and the matters pertinent to the development addressed. The proposals were moving ahead relatively smoothly, and a positive conclusion is the only way forward. More people use bicycles, the enviable bus service, or indeed walk. The new sports and leisure centre is very much needed to replace the city centre location of the River Park Leisure Centre area and provide a facility for the benefit of all. Any further procrastination is simply not justified. This most desirable and much needed project is a positive addition to the area's sports amenities. Simon Lever, Juniper Close Badger Farm.
And the next letter from John Godbold continues with the same theme. Sir, at last, Winchester residents are in sight of getting the new leisure complex and swimming pool that they have long waited for and deserve. But do not hold your breath, as the unelected and unaccountable Wynn ACC is trying to put yet more spurious arguments against this project. The time for consultation has been and gone, and Wynn ACC's original points have been noted, and it is time to complete this project. My words to Wynn ACC are, accept the will of the people of Winchester and of Winchester City Council. You have a great scheme. Get on with it. John Godbold, Lark Hill Rise, Badger Farm, Winchester.
And this letter asks the question, why divert? Sir, whether we like it or not, 2,000 new houses coupled with the developments at the station and cattle market mean change. The northern approach to Winchester will not be the same. The debate so far has focused on travel by car. For some, keeping Andover Road open is thought to make it easier and quicker to get into town. But whether Andover Road be open or closed, traffic will still come to a stop at the traffic lights by the station. The time taken to travel across town will largely be determined by how traffic is managed there. We will all be affected by the changes. No one wishes to see the residents of Harestock affected more than anyone else, and the Chronicle report of traffic modelling by the company Adam Urbanism was concerning. However, it was based on choice of, quote, shortest distance. It acknowledged that it did not take into account other impediments such as road width, local street activity or traffic calming, which can influence choice of route. Fortunately, along with the park and ride scheme and a frequent bus service, traffic calming is one of the planned mitigating measures. In all of the discussion taking place, we seem to have lost sight of the reason for the present plans. These were debated at great expense over several years and included effects on traffic flow. It was a result of this exhaustive consultation that the original design was changed to the plans that are being implemented today. Taking account of national guidance, the plans give particular attention to the social needs of people associated with the development. These include, for example, the school children living there who attend Henry Beaufort, and the green corridor that partially compensates for the much enjoyed open space lost to the new development. Perhaps more airtime could usefully be given to these non-car aspects of proposals. Different decisions bring with them different costs and different benefits, providing greater clarity and completeness as to what's being lost and gained by different options would help provide a more informed debate and balanced decision-making. And that letter comes from John Akers, who lives on Andover Road North in Winchester.
This letter from C.A. and R. Mills of Barton Farm is headed Diversion? Good. Sir, we think that the route for the new section of the Andover Road is a good one. We are confident that a great deal of detailed planning work went into the design of the King's Barton development. We do not think that there are likely to be any significant changes in the factors that determined the road plans for the King's Barton development since the planning approval was granted. The new section of the Andover Road will have two separate carriageways, with extensive traffic calming measures, and this will make the new road, and indirectly the remaining parts of the old Andover Road, safer than the current Andover Road. We understand that there is to be a new northern park and ride scheme at King's Barton that should lead to fewer car journeys through North Winchester into the city. The planned M3 motorway junction 9 improvements should reduce the number of vehicles seeking other routes into or around the city. The pedestrianisation and landscaping of part of the current Andover Road will make it safer for children crossing between the extended Henry Beaufort campus and also offer a pleasant amenity for local residents. The King's Barton scheme was approved at the highest level of government after exhaustive review, and so any proposal to amend the approved plan must be subjected to a similar level of scrutiny and democratic process. That's from C.A. and R. Mills of Barton Farm.
And in contrast to the last letter, Tim Lowry's letter is headed Diversion Bad. Sir, to make an objective and meaningful decision, it is necessary to weigh up the arguments for and against the matter in question. Many of those against the diversion of Andover Road have been eloquently expressed in your letters page. However, I do not recall any in favour. There have been artists' impressions of an idealistic, leafy, pedestrianised section of what will be created, but due to the need for existing houses to maintain car access, the road will in practice look very similar. That is, apart from the empty beer cans, discarded wine bottles, general litter and dog deposits, which are guaranteed to prevail. I live in a village north of Winchester and frequently use Andover Road. It is currently marginal whether I turn right into Hairstock on my way into town to miss the increase in traffic in the vicinity of Peter Simmons College, whether it is term time or not. In the future, like many others north of Winchester, I will need to avoid this key route into Winchester and detour via Hairstock to the Stockbridge Road to avoid consequent gridlock. The decision to divert the Andover Road is completely unjustified and foolhardy and must be reversed. Tim Lowry, Newton Stacey.
Now here's a thoughtful contribution on a completely different subject from Kenneth Corman. His letter is entitled Dig Dilemma. Sir, Andrew Rutter's letter in the Chronicle of July the 26th raises important issues about the archaeological opportunities offered by the development of Silver Hill and the relative merits of investigation and preservation. During my time as Winchester Rescue Archaeologist, later head of museums, I gained more than 30 years' experience of monitoring the impact of building projects on buried remains in the city. I cannot recall a single case where the damage to buried archaeology was less than predicted beforehand. It was always greater. This was rarely the result of willful or careless damage, but rather because of unexpected site conditions or changed requirements. My point is that even with the most careful planning towards in-situ preservation, building projects throw up unexpected threats which can result in the loss of archaeological information. The best way to avoid unforeseen damage would be through a programme of on-site evaluation to provide a detailed profile of the buried archaeological resource. Apart from its academic benefit to the enhancement of knowledge, such work would be of value to the developer in planning the most cost-effective building project. One argument for preserving, rather than digging, is that excavation techniques will continue to develop so that remains will be better recorded and yield more information in, say, 50 years than now. But if archaeological abstinence is widely applied, will there be anybody left with the necessary practical skills and experience to carry out the work? And Kenneth Coleman lives in Sutton Scotney.
This letter is headed NIMBY Stance, and just in case you've forgotten, NIMBY is an acronym for Not In My Backyard. Sir, it appears that the forces of Middle England are massing against the introduction of a free-range egg production unit at Vale Farm near Winchester, some distance from Crab Wood. I have not by any means read all of the objections to this scheme. I can understand Natural England, the Council for the Preservation of Rural England, the Woodland Trust, Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust, objecting to this scheme. That is their job. However, most of the objections seem to be based on the amenity value of the surrounding countryside for runners, cyclists, dog walkers, etc., who simply don't want to see an agricultural building in the middle of an agricultural area. The two planning applications contain several reports on ammonia impact, air quality, access, ecological appraisal, etc. Objections include no odour management plan, spreading of chicken waste, I can find no mention of this in the documentation. Welfare of the free-range hens, no 24/7 supervision. What other farming practice has 24/7 supervision? Shepherds and cowherds living in bothies are a thing of the past. Traffic movements. I can see no indication that the largest trucks allowed will be used. This is pure supposition. I believe that fewer truck movements will be needed compared to the previous pig farm that was on this site. Enmill Lane up to the Vale Farm gate is quite suitable for heavy agricultural machinery, therefore is quite capable of coping with a couple of trucks per week. Proximity to Crab Wood, a site of special scientific interest, I use Crab Wood regularly, if it is such an important site of special scientific interest, why is it full of bottles, cans, wrappers, etc., discarded by walkers, runners, cyclists, and other users, and not maintained as an amenity and a site of special scientific interest? This venture will provide some rural employment and will maintain the land in agricultural use for some time. I am ambivalent towards the venture itself, but I recognise that we are in a farming area and farmers need to make a living from their land. We do not live in Brambley Hedge. This letter is from Jeff Ward, Walton Place, Stanmore.
And the final letter today comes from Peggy Souter and concerns an increasing problem with ticks. Sir, your article, County Issues Warning to Be on Tick Alert, chronicled July the 19th, was timely. I have been bitten twice by a tick so far this summer, once in my own small garden, and once in an area of grass and trees right in the middle of Bristol. I discovered the first at 8:30 on a Sunday morning. I had tweezers to remove it, but couldn't reach it to do it myself, and for various reasons no friends or relations were available. GP surgeries were shut, of course, and pharmacists in the UK don't deal with ticks. I was fortunate that someone, in an unofficial capacity, removed it for me. The second one I discovered at 8:30 in the evening in a city I didn't know. I hadn't brought tweezers, not expecting to need them on a city holiday. In this case, the answer was A&E, in the early morning, after a 90-minute wait. The removal took all of 10 seconds, but I was very grateful. In France, pharmaceuticals expect not just to give advice, but to remove ticks. I wonder what hope there is of pharmacists being permitted and trained to deal with them here, since they are clearly becoming more common. Peggy Souter, Kingsgate Road, Winchester.
If you wish to contact the Hampshire Chronicle, you can telephone 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. You can email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or you can write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. Looking back, we begin with the news from 200 years ago. Thank you, John.
Yes, and this piece comes from the Hampshire Chronicle, dated Monday, August the 3rd, 1818. First piece. A paragraph appeared in many of the London papers last week stating that there was a violent storm of thunder, lightning, hail and rain at Romsey and its neighbourhood on Wednesday the 22nd of July. This is by no means correct, and we can assert that no trees were torn up by the roots in the New Forest, nor were any horses found dead in the neighbourhood, and it is certain that not a pane of glass belonging to Mr. Orr's summer house was broken by the hailstones, no gentleman of that name having lived at Bramshaw for many years past. And second piece is a more sombre reflection of the times. This morning was executed near this city John Biddlecombe, aged 25, Nathaniel Carter, 21, and James Williams, 28. Biddlecombe was a native of Platford in the county of Wiltshire and suffered for housebreaking at Highclere. Carter and Williams had been convicted of sheep stealing.
This piece is from 100 years ago. It's dated Saturday, August the 3rd, 1918. On Monday, a large convoy of wounded arrived at the Great Western Railway Station about 2:30 p.m., comprising 140 cot and 50 sitting cases. Cars for the conveyance of the men to the different hospitals were kindly sent by the following ladies and gentlemen through the Hampshire Automobile Association: Major Hayman, Mrs. Dutton, Mr. W. Ponting, Lady Portal, Mrs. Johnson of Marsh Court, the Marsh Court Ambulance, Miss Braithwaite, Mr. R. Chisnell, who sent motor brakes, and Mr. J. Early, the Winchester Ambulance of the Hampshire Automobile Club, and one ambulance from the club's organisation at the docks were also present. The American Troops Headquarters kindly sent their ambulances. Colonel Corkery was in charge of the arrangements, and the RAMC and VTC stretcher squads also attended and rendered valuable assistance. During the unloading of the train, refreshments and cigarettes were supplied by a number of ladies. The men were sent to the various hospitals in the city and also the Magdalen Hospital in Alresford Road. The second point. Lieutenant E. Jeffrey of the Canadian Scottish of Springvale, Kitnox Hill, Curdridge, who has died of wounds, was the younger son of the Reverend C. Jeffrey of Newfoundland. For some time he served in the Canadian Seaforth Highlanders, but had latterly been with the Canadian Scottish Regiment. He was married in November 1916, and much sympathy is extended to his young widow and little son, who survive him.
And from 50 years ago, Saturday, August the 3rd, 1968, there are two items. And the first one, the proposal of the Ministry of Transport to take 55 acres of good agricultural land to build a large flyover at Mitchell-Devo Crossroads was an absolute waste, Mr. G. May Kingsclear said. He suggested at the moment the A30 was a perfectly good road at this point, but now the ministry had suggested that the bends were a bit too sharp. Mr. A. E. L. Hill, chairman of the Roads Committee, replied that it was a ministry matter and they felt that the A30 was one of the main arteries to the west of England and had to be first class. And the second item, a local inquiry is to be set up to look into the proposal submitted by Winchester City Council to alter their area by including part of Courtney Road Estate, which at present lies within the Winchester RDC. The area involved is about 7.5 acres. The RDC have said they will raise no objection, and the committee agreed there is a prima facie case for the change.
And here we are at Friday, July the 30th, 1993, and there are two pieces here. A British Gas offer to install supplies to homes in Ropley at a cost of £1,126 per household has been branded outrageous by television journalist Alastair Stewart. Mr. Stewart is one of 450 Ropley residents to receive a letter from British Gas Southern this week. The letter states, quotes, "We are pleased to advise you of our plans to bring natural gas to your area. In order to do this, we need 113 households to decide to use gas. Natural gas is the ideal fuel. It is kind to the environment, always available, controllable, convenient, clean and economical." Close quotes. The company, which last year made a profit of £1,166 million, say the contribution of £1,126 from each household represents, quote, excellent value. Mr. Stewart told the Hampshire Chronicle, "I was flabbergasted to read the sums of money being asked by such an enormous, profitable company for the provision of what I think should be basic service. I, and I hope many others, will be contacting Offgas to appeal against the quotation. And unless it comes down dramatically, British Gas will not have made a new customer. I think the whole thing is outrageous." The cost of the scheme has also angered Janet and Gordon Page of Parkston Road, Ropley. The British Gas offer came about originally because they asked if natural gas could be connected to their property. I bet they were popular. British Gas maintains that customers would benefit from reduced fuel bills in the future. The Southern branch released a statement this week claiming that people who use electricity to heat their homes will pay up to twice as much as those who use gas. A spokesman for Offgas, the gas industry's regulator, said people could appeal against the charge, but pointed out that British Gas was entitled to charge for the installation. And now the second briefer piece. Six M3 protesters have decided to remain in prison for a month following a High Court judge's decision to punish them after they took part in a mass demonstration on Twyford Down. The judge told the protesters, "As from Monday, I make this pledge. If anyone of you wishes to come before me and purge your contempt by undertaking to be bound by the injunction in future, I will hear you sympathetically. A seventh protester took the judge up on this and was freed from Holloway Prison on Monday. The judge conceded that the protesters were all, quote, fundamentally decent citizens, but he told them that it was more important to uphold the rule of law than to save Twyford Down from destruction.
Hampshire Chronicle comment this week is read by Frieda and will be followed by First Person, read by John. Thank you, Frieda.
This is headed, "What is going on behind closed doors?" The public has a right to know what is going on behind closed doors between the St Clement's GP practice and the City Council. Planning approval was given several years ago for a new surgery on the car park at the corner of Upper Brook Street and Friars Gate. The practice is currently in a 1960s building on Tanner Street that has seen better days. Yet somehow the two sides cannot negotiate a deal that would allow the practice to relocate the several hundred yards. This is a very important part of the city centre. In the long term, the Tanner Street site will be in the heart of the central Winchester rejuvenation area. The practice has an estimated 16,000 patients. Yet all we know about the deadlock is a brief mention in a council report to the planning committee. The head of estates at the council writes, "Earlier advice that it would be a minimum of 19 months before the practice would be able to vacate the premises has altered. Despite discussions between Winchester City Council and the doctors over a number of years, it is now looking unlikely that an agreement can be reached. Too much of public life in this country is habitually mired in secrecy. The GP practice is part of the public-funded NHS. The City Council is publicly funded too. We have a right to know what is going on."
Yes, and this think piece is contributed by George Hayter and is entitled "Teach Finance Before Maths." My father knew about money. He always read the business pages of the Daily Telegraph, and sometimes he even bought the Financial Times. He owned a few company shares, and when I was about 13, he expressed an interest in buying some shares for his son. Of course, I was pleased, and I suggested that he buy shares for me in EMI. The year was around 1965, and Beatlemania was at its height. I was a fan of the Fab Four, whose records were released on the Parlophone label, which was a part of EMI. Dad was dubious about the long-term earning power of pop music, but he deferred to my adolescent enthusiasm. I assured him that the Beatles would enjoy more years at the top of the charts. And I was right. 5 years of global number one hits followed for John, Paul, George and Ringo. Nevertheless, the company somehow mismanaged its diversified affairs and the share price declined. In the long term, the shrunken value of my EMI holding didn't really matter. That wasn't the important thing. Dad, being an investor and giving me a few hundred pounds of shares, had introduced me to capitalism. That taught me the benefits of patiently accumulating wealth rather than spending all I earned. And I stayed an investor and a saver for the rest of my life. Still in my 20s, I was reading the personal finance pages of the Sunday papers and starting to drip surplus income into everything, from UK property bonds to an Indian investment trust. Despite having always been a modest wage earner, I now enjoy a comfortable retirement thanks to unfaltering investment in shares, pooled investments, pensions and homes. So thanks, Dad. Other people's fathers may have had other shining qualities, but they don't all put their offspring on the road to financial security in the way that mine did. Today's young people risk never learning about financial responsibility. Many young kids are destined for adulthood without being warned about the dangers of getting into debt, except mortgages or student debt. They may embark on their working lives without knowing the security and destiny-shaping power that comes from saving and investing. I don't remember being taught any personal finance at school. These days, financial education is in the national curriculum, but not in a big way. Budgeting and financial products are amongst topics covered in citizenship, key stages 3 and 4. And percentages and compound interest are part of money matters tackled in maths at the same stages. For many years, teachers have been bombarded with curriculum changes, so I wouldn't want to see any more government diktats. But I wonder if teachers might consider mentioning some money matters in younger classes. Could finance be taught before pupils have mastered basic maths? For many youngsters, maths is an insurmountable hurdle. Surely, lack of number skills should never stop a child receiving vital education about money. Delaying vital instruction on personal finance because children cannot perform calculations would handicap the most disadvantaged young people. Rather than children being forced to progress through maths to finance, the two subjects can be a virtuous circle, the one stimulating interest in the other. Children don't need to understand maths before they can grasp the importance of building up savings and shunning debt. I think that giving kids basic saving skills can give them an appetite for number skills like addition, through to advanced finance-related concepts such as percentages. Most children like the idea of becoming rich. They don't need numeracy to grasp the need to accumulate cash, avoid debt, and pay into a pension. Not all teachers are confident about teaching finance, but, and some heads may not know this, there are charities who can send a specialist to deliver a key lesson.
Belgorham's alternative look at the news this week comprises 3 items, and the first is read by Maria.
And the first item is headed Drama Meets Reality. A meeting of drama and reality took place when Winchester businessman Danny Habel met actors from the Blue Apple Theatre Company during celebrations following the successful run of their latest play, Winchester, the First Million Years, at the Theatre Royal. The show included the story of Danny's Jewish parents being given refuge in the UK in 1939 when they fled Nazi Germany, and how they came to set up a shop in Winchester. Blue Apple actors Lucy Parrott and Laurie Morris played the Habels and were fascinated and moved to browse through the family photograph albums that Danny shared with the cast. Laurie said, "My best moment in the play was being able to portray somebody's father." Danny said, "I was privileged to be invited to watch the Blue Apple Theatre production. To see my family included in the city's history was an honour, and the excellent performances of Lucy and Laurie playing the parts of my parents was very moving. The plot contrasted the cruel expulsion of the Jewish community from England in 1290 with the welcome extended to the Habel family in the 20th century to show how society has progressed in the past 700 years. There were just 2 scenes in the play that was full of interest, entertainment and fun." And there is a photograph of this article with Danny Habel and the cast browsing through his family's photograph albums.
Car boot washout. Talk about bad luck. For the last 2 or 3 months, we've been blessed with beautiful blue skies. Every Sunday, a car boot sale is held at the Cattle Market car park, except this Sunday, it wasn't. This photo was taken at about 10 a.m. on a rain and wind-lashed expanse of car park. Every week, a charity benefits to the tune of several hundred pounds from the usually packed car park by being able to charge the car booters a fee. On Sunday, it was due to be Alresford Rotary, which was unavailable for comment, and the The photograph that Belgarum refers to is indeed a desolate scene. It's almost completely deserted car park at the cattle market, lashed by wind and rain, with one poor forlorn car parked in the middle. Somebody in there clearly hoping that it will stop and he can sell his goods.
So unlucky.
Yeah.
This piece, excuse me, this piece is headed Cross-Party Support at Last. To those who thought it would never happen, there's finally proof that Winchester's Lib Dems and Tories can share support for a policy. The revelation came on Twitter through Lib Dem councillor Martin Todd after the city's Conservative MP Steve Brine announced a new policy in the House of Commons. Mr. Brine, who is also Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State at the Department of Health, announced that boys aged 12 and 13 in England will be given a vaccine to prevent them from getting HPV-related cancers. The vaccine not only protects men from HPV-related cancers, such as oral, throat and anal cancer, but also helps reduce the overall number of cervical cancers in women. Following the announcement, Councillor Todd tweeted, "Credit where credit is due. This is a very good decision by @BrimeMinister." However, it might be asking a little too much to get agreement on Silver Hill 2 and Winchester's new leather centre.
This week's announcements begin with What's On, and here are some events happening in and around Winchester in the forthcoming days. On Tuesday the 7th of August, the lunchtime recital at Winchester Cathedral will feature Michael Christian Durrant with a selection of music for the Spanish guitar. The recital is free with a retiring collection. Also on Tuesday the 7th of August, there's a free lunchtime recital at Romsey Abbey, again with a retiring collection. On Wednesday the 8th of August, at 7:30 p.m, the Winchester Horticultural Society hosts a talk by Timothy Walker, Director of Oxford Botanic Garden, entitled How to Be a 21st Century Gardener. The cost to visitors is £3. On Friday the 17th and Saturday the 18th of August, the Wessex Quilt Makers exhibition, Nearly 40, will be at the Middlebrook Centre, Winchester, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And admission is £2.50 with children free, and there will be the raffle of a quilt. An exhibition on the role of Gurkhas during the Great War and other conflicts from 1914 to 1922 continues at the Gurkha Museum until August the 30th, while the exhibition at the Winchester Discovery Centre of work by Agnes Martin, American abstract artist, continues until October the 7th. Lighting Up Time ends on Friday the 3rd of August at 5:33 p.m. and begins at 8:50 p.m. On Wednesday the 8th of August, it ends at 5:41 a.m. and begins at 8:40 p.m. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you have now received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. That's 01962 870 370. And now we continue with items of general news, and the first item is read by Maria. Thank you, Maria.
Water garden is protected. Councillors have approved measures which would stop development on a Winchester beauty spot. As previously reported, the water garden, which backs onto Winchester Cathedral, was sold for more than £100,000 earlier this year, sparking fears that it may be redeveloped. Concerns were first raised about the water garden when the Colebrick Street site was put up for sale in December. The listing by Winchester estate agents Belgarum said there may be future development potential, Those concerns had resurfaced after a proposal to build a single-storey dwelling on the site was discussed at a meeting in April. As a result, Winchester City Council sought a tree protection order, which was last week approved by the Council's Planning Committee. The committee heard that the trees are of sufficient public benefit and public visual amenity value to be protected, and the unanimous approval by councillors now, in effect, stops any development plans. The proposal was put before the committee after an objection was lodged on behalf of the Water Gardens owner, understood to be a consortium including Hampshire UKIP leader Alan Stone. According to the council report, the objector states that in his opinion, there is nothing about either of the trees to suggest the removal of the trees would have a negative effect on the local environment. He considers that it is not expedient to serve the TPO as the trees are not under immediate threat. The objector states that pruning work is now needed to address the abrasion of the adjacent buildings by branches from the trees, and the implementation of this work structurally comprises the trees, and therefore the trees would not meet the criteria for protection by a TPO. Sorry, that was compromises, not comprises. The committee heard from Councillor Linda Murphy, who spoke in support of protecting the trees. She said, "It has become clear to me how much the public appreciate the water garden and the trees. I have had a letter from Sir Peter Smithers, the creator of the water garden, and former Winchester MP daughter, Amelia. She said he had a particular love for magnolias, the trees under the TPO." Alison Drayton, speaking on behalf of the Hampshire Garden Trust, added, "The garden has become iconic in its own right. The trees are in excellent health. Apart from a small amount of pruning, they can serve their function for decades to come." As previously reported, Mr. Stone denied that he planned to build a home on the water garden and said he wants to carry out work on the trees so it could be used to hold functions. He said, "Well, what's the point of having something that beautiful and building on it? We have a nice block of land. We want to do something with it." Asked about calls for it to be kept a tourist site, Mr. Smith added, "If the council wanted to buy it, they had the opportunity." Prior to February, the land had been owned by Lady Barbara Calcutt, the widow of Sir David Calcutt, before she died. It was then passed on to her executor, who arranged the sale. And there is a photograph of the very beautiful water garden off Colebrook Street, which backs onto Winchester Cathedral.
A dramatic headline. Family of four endure bus ride from hell. A family had the bus ride from hell after almost being locked in a depot overnight after the driver failed to check that the vehicle was empty. Martin Lee says the experience has given his daughters nightmares. The Lee family, from Albert Street and Gosport, had spent the day in Winchester after Father Martin, 54, had been to the Royal Hampshire Hospital to receive the results of a scan on his foot. After a day out in the city, Martin, his wife Kaylee, aged 30, and their daughters Phoebe, 5, and Amy, 9, jumped aboard what they thought was the 5:10 p.m. stagecoach bus to Fareham. However, after the bus left Waltham Chase, it began to speed up and eventually ended up at the Botley bus park, although the Lees didn't realise this at the time. "The bus stopped," said Dad, "and the driver got out. We thought maybe he just needed the toilet or was changing over. Then he came back and we pulled into what looked like an industrial estate. The driver then got out and locked the bus, trapping the family inside." Martin continues, "The kids were screaming. We all ran to the back of the bus and started banging on the window. Thankfully, he noticed us and let us out. Otherwise, we'd have been stuck in there overnight. I don't know how he didn't realise we were up there with two kids chatting away. We weren't exactly silent. He never checked the bus or said he was at the last stop." The driver told them that there were no bus stops close by and they'd have to get a train home. Mr. Lee said that the family couldn't afford the train and had paid for a day bus ticket. However, the driver told them it wasn't his problem. After leaving the Botley bus park, the family began to walk towards Wickham, but were luckily picked up by a good Samaritan working at the Silver Lake Automotive Recycling Centre, who insisted on giving the family a lift back to Gosport. Mr. Lee said, "He was a star. I couldn't thank him enough. My daughters have been traumatised by the experience and have had nightmares as a result." A Stagecoach spokesperson said, "We are extremely disappointed and concerned at the circumstances in which a family were left on one of our buses returning to the Botley bus yard. A full internal investigation will be conducted. All drivers are expected to check their buses at the end of the journey, but this clearly did not occur. We'd like to apologise to Mr. Lee and his family for the distress caused, and we will be reminding staff of the importance of inspecting the vehicle at the end of every service."
This piece is headed "Crowds Toast a Grape Success." Hampshire is fast becoming recognised globally as a leading winemaking region, and crowds flocked to a county vineyard to get a taste of the action. Visitors to the annual Vineyards of Hampshire Wine Festival at Rames Vineyard at New Cheriton were given their own engraved tasting glass and the opportunity to sample wine from 7 vineyards. Excuse me. Master classes took place throughout the afternoon, including growing your own vine and comparison of English fizz, cava, prosecco, and champagne. Augusta Rames from Rames English Sparkling Wine said, "We've had a wonderful day of wine, music and food. It has been a joy to show off the vineyard as it is looking so good this year and is full of huge bunches of grapes." Emily Lambert, the first female sommelier at the Ritz and winner of BBC Two's Million Pound Menu, opened the festival. The vineyards involved were Cottonworth, Danebury, Exton Park, Jenkin Place, Hambledon, Hattingley and Rames. Each year a different vineyard hosts the event. Several of the vineyards are also open throughout the summer for cellar door days. And there is a photograph of the 7 executive producers clutching bottles of champagne, sparkling wine, looking very happy, and sitting on a seat made of bales of hay.
Winchester Bible to inspire floral festival. Winchester Cathedral Flower Festival returns this year with Illumination, a festival of flowers, from September the 5th to the 9th. This year's event features an array of flower arrangements inspired by the Winchester Bible, the finest surviving 12th century English Bible. The cathedral will once again be transformed by striking and fragrant floral displays. Visitors will be invited to immerse themselves in a riot of colour and admire a variety of arrangements evoking the Winchester Bible's exquisite decorative schemes, coloured with gold and lapis lazuli. One volume of the Bible is currently on display in the North Transept. From next year, all 4 volumes will be displayed in the multi-million pound exhibition Kings and Scribes. Returning to the festival is creative director Angela Turner, having designed the 2013 Flower Festival. And there is a photograph of Angela Turner, who's a regular exhibitor at the Chelsea Flower Show, and she's standing between 2 incredibly beautiful floral displays, which I don't know whether she did them herself or whether they're by other people, but they're very beautiful.
And here's a warning on impact of weather on farmers. With temperatures breaking records, a southeast agricultural expert has said he's worried about the strain the heat wave is having on the farming community. Johnny Denman of Rural Insurance Specialists Lycett said the heat and lack of rain in recent months is taking its toll on farmers who are faced with animal welfare issues, crop failure concerns and wildfire risks. He's warned that farming businesses will have an uphill battle to recover and could be dealing with the effects of the heatwave until early next year. Mr. Denman said, "Farmers are hurtling towards a crisis point. They've been battling to survive this heatwave, faced with drought, tinderbox fields and livestock they can't feed. They're growing increasingly desperate with every day. Crop yields are down at least 10% due to the dryness."
Hampshire Charter for Carers is the first in the country. A charter to support the army of adult carers in Hampshire has been launched in what has become the first of its kind in the country. The legislation, developed with voluntary organisations, sets out a series of commitments for how Hampshire County Council and the NHS will work with carers to support them. The Hampshire Joint Carers Strategy outlines how health and social care professionals, alongside the voluntary sector, will work together. They will identify and recognise people who are looking after someone in their community to ensure that they are aware of the support available to them. They will support carers' physical health and emotional well-being. They will help carers to have a life alongside caring. And they will support young adult carers aged under 25. They will also reach out to seldom heard carers, such as travellers or carers in rural communities. Councillor Liz Fairhurst, adult social care and health head for the authority, said, "There are an estimated 133,000 carers currently in Hampshire, making a huge contribution to our communities by helping to care for those who need support. We recognise that carers frequently put the needs of the person they care for before their own, often placing their own health and well-being at risk. As many people with caring responsibilities see themselves as simply helping out a loved one, carers often don't know about or actively seek the carer support that is available to them. The Charter recognises the important role undertaken by the county's many carers and makes clear how we will support them in their role. The Hampshire Joint Carers Strategy itself outlines how health and social care professionals, alongside the voluntary sector, will work together to support those looking after others. Ros Hartley, Director of Partnerships for Hampshire and Isle of Wight CCG Partnership, said, "Many people care for family members, and because they can see it as their duty to their loved ones, they do not always think to ask for anything to help themselves, or they put their own health needs last. This can lead to them suffering physical or mental health problems themselves. We want all carers in Hampshire to know what support and advice is available to them and to be able to access that support so they can remain fit and healthy. The healthier the carer, the better quality of care they can provide. County social services bosses say the strategy will be reviewed and updated when needed to reflect the needs of the county's carers as they change."
Bikers gather to help tackle loneliness. More than 120 motorcyclists braved the weather to gather in Kingsworthy to raise funds for a charity that tackles loneliness. The bikers raised more than £400 for MHA Live at Home Hampshire, a charity that works locally to socially support and reduce isolation and loneliness in older people aged over 60. The gathering was held at the Worthy Sports and Social Club on Loveden Lane on Saturday. The fire service put on biker down demonstrations. There were trade stalls and live music from the Mosquitoes, Hannah Bolzover, Reloaded, and With the Bloodhounds. Lee Shergold, community fundraiser for MHA, said, "Thank you to the amazing bikers who came from all across the county, despite the weather, to help us raise money to reduce isolation and loneliness in older people." And the photographs show a huge array of motorbikes. One of them's decorated with a skull and a skeleton bride.
Kids in the Cathedral. Winchester Cathedral is organising lots of things for families to do over the holidays. It has set up family trails on Wednesdays between 10 and 1pm. Adults are asked to pay the normal entry charge, but children under 16 go free. And last entry for craft activities is 30 minutes before the end of each session. The trail on August the 1st and August the 22nd features the animals around the Great Church, and children can make a clay animal at the craft table. On August the 8th and 29th, the focus is on the many coats of arms to be seen around the cathedral. And on August the 15th, they focus on the bishops of Winchester, and the children are encouraged to make their own puppet bishops.
Fly tip penalty. Winchester's civic chiefs have issued their first fly tipping fixed penalty notice and warned offenders the crackdown will continue. A man who dumped household waste in a bin belonging to a business in Whiteley paid the £400 fine last week after he was traced by the council's environmental enforcement officers. The offender had dumped the waste while using a company van, which allowed the council to find him easily. The company handed over his details after being told they could be liable for the fine because he had used their vehicle to get rid of the rubbish. Councillor Lisa Griffiths, portfolio holder for health and wellbeing, said, "The council will do everything in its power to find those who fly tip and make sure they pay this hefty fine. This sort of activity is antisocial, and residents who are victims of it are rightly fed up and want us to take action like this. Make no mistake, this crackdown will continue, and the stark message for those who fly tip is this: dispose of your rubbish properly or face losing £400.
Surprise visit as film crew roll up at City's Antiques Emporium to shoot programme. Vintage lovers at Winchester's Molly's Den had a surprise visit when the stars of BBC's Celebrity Antiques Road Trip turned up to film an episode. Antiques expert Philip Serrell and One Show and Watchdog star Michelle Ackerley arrived at the Eastern Lane Emporium in a classic Mercedes 220 SE convertible, where they were greeted by Molly's Den Winchester store manager Stephen Berry and new owner John East Rigby. Molly's Den have three sites along the south coast, including the Winchester branch, and each is filled with hundreds of traders selling vintage, retro, and antique collectibles and pieces. The team said they were delighted to receive a phone call just a few days before filming took place to ask if they would be happy to be a location. The show sees celebrities working with an antiques expert in a bid to find gems to take to auction. All the money raised goes to children in need. Manager Stephen Berry said the filming went very well, with the team staying a few hours and having a good look round at items to buy. He said they were very friendly, quite chatty. "I went around with Philip and we identified a few items that might be of interest to them before they went to explore further." Philip and Michelle had a quick cup of tea in the cafe before heading downstairs to the till to bag a bargain. Molly's Den regulars will recognise Stephen, as he will be playing a starring role when the episode airs, making the final deal at the till. New owner, John East Rigby, took over the Emporium late last year. He said, "It was great to have them at Molly's Den. It was very exciting to have the film crew there. It's the first time since I took over last year that we have had them in. I hope they had a wonderful time exploring the treasure trove that is Molly's den, and hopefully we will see them back soon. The episode is set to air on TV in the autumn, and there's a photograph of Philip and Michelle with Stephen Berry standing at the entrance to Molly's den and all looking very pleased with their bargains.
Highways teams facing rapid growth in weeds. As the county bakes in what is set to be the hottest British summer on record, county council workers are tackling an outbreak of weeds which are burgeoning in the heatwave. Already this summer, teams have destroyed around 18,500 square metres of the invasive weeds, spraying them with a special herbicide. This, the council says, is friendlier to the environment and kills weeds systematically. This treatment normally takes place over the summer along footways and curbs in towns and villages. Hampshire County Council manages around 5,500 miles of roads and 2,000 miles of roadside verges. Councillor Rob Humby, Executive Member for Environment and Transport at Hampshire County Council, says, "Our highways teams cut grass and treat weeds once a year, although overgrown vegetation affecting sight lines and safety on the roads is always dealt with as an emergency, and I would urge people to report this to us as soon as they can. The heat wave seems to have slowed the growth of grass, but there are areas where the weeds are very robust, and while weeds growing on roads and footways are not dangerous, they're certainly unsightly and can cause damage to road surfaces. We are aware of the problem and grateful to residents and our colleagues at the district councils who've alerted us to areas which need particular attention." Councillor Humby added, "I'd like to reassure residents that there will be extra highways crews out now until the end of the growing season to tackle weeds as part of a targeted programme." Hampshire County Council also has a record of known growth sites of injurious and invasive weeds, such as Japanese knotweed, giant hogweed and mare's tail, and these are treated three times a year. Ragwort is controlled through a combination of hand pulling and cutting.
TV insight into the unique New Forest. A new TV series which shines a spotlight on ancient traditions in the New Forest has started. A Year in the New Forest is a four-part insight into what the makers describe as the unique nature of the people and animals who live in the area. The first episode showed the forest in autumn, when the leaves turn red and gold and pigs roam freely in search of acorns during the panage season. The other hour-long episodes follow life in the forest through the seasons, celebrating its landscape and the people who care passionately about preserving its ancient way of life. Excuse me. Much of the series focuses on people known as commoners, villagers with the right to let their ponies, cows and donkeys graze the forest. Describing how the commoners and their animals coexist, one woman says, "They're not friends. You're never friends, but you do have a relationship." The series also shows red deer taking part in the annual rut, and mushroom experts examining some of the 2,500 species of fungi found in the forest. Climate change and other problems presented by the 21st century are among the other areas explored. Anthony Climpson is chief executive of Go New Forest, which works to promote the area's tourism industry. He said, "These programs will help remind viewers just what a great place the New Forest is to spend a day, a short break, or longer holiday. The beautiful weather this summer is leading many to rediscover the joys of spending time in rural England. Our research shows the New Forest is already attracting many more young people who not only want to reconnect with nature, but enjoy a little luxury. We hope the TV series will emphasise to viewers the New Forest is the perfect place for this sort of refreshment and renewal, where tranquil, romantic landscapes provide an antidote to the stress of modern life. A Year in the New Forest is on Channel 4 on Saturdays at 7 p.m.
Great War Focus for Museum. The Gurkha Museum's 1918 summer exhibition will focus on the role of the Gurkhas during the Great War and its following conflicts from 1914 to 1922. Prior to the First World War, Gurkha regiments had seldom been deployed outside of East Asia, but the changes in warfare brought about by the conflict led to the Gurkhas being deployed across Europe and the Middle East. The exhibition aims to show how Gurkha bravery and determination, in the face of extreme conditions and unfamiliar methods of warfare, proved their worth time and again to the Allied forces. This led to a greater awareness of the abilities of the Gurkha soldiers and their officers, and affected how Gurkha service in the First World War has been commemorated. The role of the Gurkhas in British service thus began to change from that of an exceptional regional force to a key part of Britain's global military structure, which has continued for the past century, helping ensure that Gurkhas remain part of the British Army today. The Gurkha Museum's collections team has used artifacts from within its collections and material from its archive, as well as the help of its museum volunteers, to tell the story of the Gurkhas' First World War in a detailed and respectful manner, and hopes to shed more light on an important aspect of the conflict. The exhibition is being held in the MacDonald Gallery of the Gurkha Museum from August the 2nd to August the 30th.
Here's news of a very happy and successful local event. Partying in the Park in Stanmore. Winchester Party in the Park returned to the summer's close recreation ground in Stanmore. The party on Saturday was arranged by the City Council, A2 Dominion and the nearby Carroll Centre. It featured a children's fun fair, go-karting, a petting farm and an educational reptile experience. There were also trial sessions of the new Children's Cube soft play facility and refreshments from the new community cafe in the Carroll Centre. The free event also included performances from magicians Steve-O and Kai, Romsey-Old Cadets and Otterbourne Brass Band. Steve Ruggles, chairman of the group Winchester in the Park, said, "Members of the committee would like to thank the local community, our partners and sponsors for their support. We're particularly grateful to University of Winchester, Hampshire County Council, Osborne, PH Jones and JC Scooters for their contribution this year." And there are three lovely photographs accompanying that. A young lady having real fun on what looks like a scooter obstacle course. A vast array of fun things for children to do, slides and roundabouts and stalls, and a family who are really enjoying themselves out in the sun.
From St Catherine's Hill to Mount Snowdon, Winchester Rotary members have been practising for the Snowdon Challenge in aid of a hospice appeal. Standing in for steep slopes of the Welsh Mountain has been the gentler gradients of St Catherine's Hill. The group of Rotarians and friends will be walking up Snowdon on Saturday, August the 18th, in aid of the Winchester Hospice Fundraising Appeal, the club's main charity for the 2018-19 Rotary Year. The walk aims to contribute £10,000 to the £2.5 million needed to refurbish Burrell House as a new 10-bed hospice. Snowdon is the highest mountain in Wales, at an elevation of 1,085 metres above sea level, and the highest point in the British Isles, outside the Scottish Highlands. It is over 10 times the height of Winchester's St Catherine's Hill. The photo shows some of the group on their first practice walk a few weeks ago on an ascent of St. Catherine's Hill. Since the photo was taken, there have been several training events in preparation for the big day.
And that concludes the extracts for this week. Thank you to our editors, Angela Ling, Carol Fraser and Jane Thomas. Thanks to our copying and dispatch and studio preparation teams. And thank you to our readers, Maria Head.
Goodbye.
John Regan.
Bye-bye now.
And Frieda Bates.
Goodbye.
And from me, Tom Williams, goodbye, and do enjoy your week ahead. Please post your memory sticks back as soon as possible in the yellow wallet, and when you put the label in the wallet, please ensure the cord is attached to the memory stick and that it is fully inside the wallet. Thank you.